announcements, and then I'll go with your Jim.
All right, at this time, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker for tonight, Evelyn from...
Eileen.
Eileen from Aurora Grande.
All right.
My name's Eileen, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 6, 2008, and my home group is the Wednesday Back to the 40s meeting up in Morro Bay at 8:30 p.m. I wanted to start off by reading something that we read at my home group, Back to the 40s. It's called The 12 Steps of Insanity, and we'll see if anyone can identify with these. One, we admitted we were powerless over nothing, that we could manage our lives perfectly and those of anyone else who would allow us. Two, came to believe there was no power greater than ourselves and the rest of the world was insane. Three, made a decision to have our loved ones and friends turn their wills and lives over to our care, even though they couldn't understand us at all. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of everyone we knew. Five, admitted to the world at large the exact nature of everyone else's wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to make others straighten up and do right. Seven, demanded others to either shape up or ship out. Eight, made a list of all persons who had harmed us and became willing to go to any lengths to get even with them all. Nine, got direct revenge on such people wherever possible, except when to do so would cost us our own lives or at the very least a jail sentence. 10, continued to take the inventory of others when they were wrong, promptly and repeatedly told them about it. 11, sought through bitching and nagging to improve our relations with others as we couldn't understand them at all, asking only that they knuckle under and do things our way. 12, having had a complete physical, emotional, and spiritual breakdown as the result of these steps, we tried to blame it on others and to get sympathy and pity in all our affairs. These steps describe the practicing alcoholic. Can anyone identify with these? Do these steps sound familiar? Perhaps these 12 steps of insanity are so accurate you could add your name to each and every one. And these come from back in the 40s. And things then with alcoholism haven't changed to the way it is today. That's why I like to go back to the book, which is my anchorage. But I wasn't always like that. I started out very, very much in an I know stage. I remember when I was 7 years old, I always would say, I know. So that was my answer to everything, and my parents would discipline me for always saying, I know. And everything was my favorite. Once I found something I liked, that was my favorite. So I had an addictive gene in me pretty much from the get-go with my behaviors, because my alcoholism is, those bottles are just a symptom, because this thing is an inside job. And I kept thinking that every time I would get sober that I would just magically straighten out physically, mentally, spiritually, just because I'm not drinking. And it took me having to go by this sign. I love this sign right here because I was definitely the type that would have a lot of arguments, and I would keep in everlasting ignorance because I had that contempt prior to investigation. So I had to do a lot of contrary action to bend myself the other way. But it says in the book that we alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in only the way He knows how. Because if I tell you what you're doing before you're ready to hear it, it's not going to sink in until it's right at that right time. So I didn't get sober a day earlier than I was supposed to, although I had been trying all these other times. I was born in L.A. and then I moved up here to Napomo when I was 8 years old, and it was like a culture shock, and everybody had known each other since they were born, so I automatically saw the differences, and that's also something that I did when I first came to meetings. I still have a propensity to do that and get really judgmental on the differences, but the book tells me that that we can identify with each other, not from the schematics of the details, but from the underlying feelings underneath. And I definitely felt that despair when I was brand new. I get beaten into a state of desperation, and that's when my mind can get cracked open just enough to be a little bit more willing to try something new against my best thinking. And I also like this sign because it's the true test of an alcoholic. on page 44. That's what we say up there at the back of the 40s in class one, where we go over step one. Is there's two questions. One is, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. And the other is, if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take. And that was definitely me over and over and over again. And I kind of got to a point where, like, I resigned myself to that identity. And all the people that I idolized, because I had a very shattered sense of self, all the people that I idolized were people that were like this 12 steps of insanity thing. It was my way or the highway. And that kind of attitude, even though my motives were good, kept me in fight mode against anything and everyone. And the world and its problems dominated me. So part of my chief symptom of that was drinking. And I picked out a part here because it's always like a good thing to bring up the anchorage. Somebody was sharing and they're like, it's called Alcoholics Anonymous because there's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, well, duh. But I had to kind of later, that voice kept coming from my head like, okay, there is a reason for this, because for me, when I came to the meetings for a long time, it was about the social end of it and just to be dry. And then I thought I would gain maturity just by being dry. And I was acting out on all those let me point out your character defects so that I could ignore mine kind of stuff. And I like this part right here where it says that cling to the thought that in God's hands the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. So I used to call them problems. I have all these problems. And now I reworded it and I call them opportunities. Because it's through those different opportunities that I've become the person. I had to go through all that stuff to get right here, standing right here in this moment with all of you to tell you what I've learned up until this point. And I was thinking about it on my way here, like, okay, I've come this far to tell you this. What do I have to tell you? And what I can tell you is that I'm the nut that was the repeated relapser. That's my wrench to that, is because even though I knew that I was these two things, I had just resigned myself to that fact, and I couldn't bend who I thought that I was into what's up in this book, because I was a nonconformist. And so I was an individual. And when I found myself finally getting beat into this state of desperation after 8 years of yo-yoing in and out of this program, I saw the way that my life was going to go by what was happening to everyone around me, dropping like flies, or just keeping miserable. My disease wants me dead, but it'll take me miserable and just, you know, keep me alive for 40 years in a state of this, you know, like we have this triangle in here with the honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness in the unity, service, and recovery. But then I had this small triangle, like my house, the liquor store, and the neighbor down the street. Like, so it was, I could see a lot of parallels to, and I can apply hustle that I used out there. Like they say, if you put in, you get out of it what you put into it. And so if I put in half the effort that I put in towards my my disease, I've got a pretty fair shot, because that to me was a 24-hour-a-day job. And now I just do these maintenance steps every day of 10, 11, and 12. But it says here, we grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. That's my favorite thing to hear about at meetings. The gratitude that people have, even in the face of whatever is happening with them that day that may feel like it will never pass. And that's what all the old timers tell me around here, is this too shall pass, which is great, because I can't get too attached to what's temporary. And I always think that I'm going to be one certain way. And if I'm growing and changing, then I'm going to have to learn how to let a lot of stuff go. a lot of the columns in my four-step were blank because I didn't know what my part in it was. And my part was I was holding it around, dragging it around, whipping other people with my past and with my triggers. And so that's the beauty of the second and third step, is where I can give it up to my higher power. And I'm really glad that you guys have love and tolerance in here, because I went to a few other programs that weren't so loving and tolerant, and I needed a place that wouldn't try to kick my ass in the parking lot and stuff like that. And so I would keep looking from place to place to get where I get fed, just like I did out there. I do it in here to keep my recovery alive and vibrant. And then always keeping going back to the book and constantly doing that step one, which really helps when I see people that were around when I first started getting sober. They always remind me where I came from. I'm really grateful that old timers keep coming to the meetings. I didn't want to get into a lot of the nitty-gritty because I spent my last pitch really getting into the nitty-gritty, and then I had barely any time to tell you what it's like now. And the way that things have changed now compared to the way that I was before, which was exactly like these 12 steps of insanity, is drastically different. I have a relationship with my family today where I was estranged from all my family members, mostly my whole life. So I didn't really think that I had a, would even want that. It's crazy how like something that I didn't think I'd want last year suddenly becomes relevant this year, the more that I'm growing. And I remember like when I was in the rehab 5 years ago, I had told my aunt when I was in my disease, I said I was going to burn her house down, and I never talked to her again. So needless to say, that was like a pain in my heart that I carried around with me. And all this wreckage, if I don't face it and work through it, it's going to come to my doorstep sooner or later where I'm going to have to face it and walk through it. And I know that for me, when all those other times that I decided to relapse, I was turning away. I could not look at whatever it was, and I did not have the faith and courage inside to walk through it. So I would go back to what I knew. And today, every day is different. I knew what every day was like before. It was always the same kind of thing one way or another. And today in sobriety, every day presents a new exciting challenge of a way to grow and get to practice being present and being aware. Because I can sit up here and be like on total autopilot when I'm sharing with you guys and not even be tapped into like connecting with this room. And so that's one of the things that I'm working on. But with my aunt, when we didn't talk anymore for a few years, at the rehab, we were going to have a mediation session with a therapist, and so that we could talk to each other because it was so volatile, and I wanted to repair that relationship. And so she drove like 100 miles to come to do this mediation. And when she got there, it was all scheduled for a certain time, and the therapist was like, I'm heading out. I can't do this right now. I was not in her good favor because I was very intense in early recovery, and I would just like stare daggers at people and like really like grab under their skin with my energy. And this therapist could not deal with me. She just had enough. And she was like, just all of a sudden turned her back. And my aunt could have said, well, I don't want to do it either. Or I could have said, well, I'm going to my room. I don't want to do it. But we were left there alone with each other when she turned her back and didn't really give an explanation. And that was the turning point. And there's all kinds of turning points that I come towards. Every single day, there's little situations like that that are little crossroads saying, okay, which way are we going to take? And I'm really glad that right there on that moment, my aunt said, you want to go out to coffee? And it was raining, and we went out to coffee, and I was scared to be alone with her because I was so easily triggered by people's words, or even just if they looked at me or did a certain body language. I was so triggered that I would just be completely out of control. And so I was worried to be alone with her, but I went, and I, behind the scenes, had been working with a sponsor because they made us get a sponsor and do the first 5 steps in that rehab. And so I had been like picturing the purple flame of Saint Germain, which was something that my sponsor was into, and she was all into like Sedona, Arizona, and all these crystals and stuff, and like her higher power was love. And I was like, I could do that. I could believe in loving kindness. I believe in that. I believe that that's a force that can change, work miracles, and do things. And so I was using these different tools that I got from the meetings, from my sponsor, in that situation. And when we went to coffee, I couldn't tell you what was said. I don't remember. It was 5 years ago. But since then, I've gone back to the house that I threatened to burn down. That was a big turning point, too. Well, that was last year I did that. So I'm a slow grower, you know? Like, I wanted to be, like, right away healed, right away, like, big shotism. And it really doesn't happen like that for me, and thank goodness it doesn't, because for me, one of my biggest sticking points is humility. And so if I got everything all at once, I really wouldn't even know what to do with it. But when I get these different turning points, like going to that house and spending time and having it be, you know, an easy does it time, I put that sticker right on the front of my book, because my control issues can just get right in there and strong arm any simple situation. And that's what they tell me up at the back to the 40s is, the simple, plain, unvarnished truth. That's how we go through to apply to different situations, because I put all these conceptualizations and all my perception on all these different things, when the simple, plain, unvarnished truth is I'm sitting in front of a room talking to 50 or so people. A simple, plain, unvarnished truth. But if I put my perception one on top of the other, oh man, it gets built up way beyond anything that it even is at all. Another thing that I wanted to share was this other part that says, let's see, we cannot subscribe to the belief that this life is a veil of tears, though it once was just that for many of us. Avoid then the deliberate manufacture of misery, but if trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence. And that, I love that part, especially since I pronounced it right, because when I was reading this back to the 40s, I said omnipotence, and everyone's like, oh, look at you. And I never forgot that. That's the thing. Today, when I'm doing things in sobriety, I move through them, not around them, because I'm present, and I can remember what happened. Oh, okay. Avoid that pitfall the next time. But before it was like, gonna backtrack, or I don't even remember what happened because I was just in a brownout or a blackout or whatever it is. And I was in various stages of gray. Every day was gray. I looked up and didn't know what day it was, what time it was. Every day just melded one into the same. And that's what I've resigned my life into. That's why I believe in miracles today. I put on my necklace right here, I put the word blessed, because I truly feel blessed. And that kind of word would have just freaked me out in the very beginning, because I was so, I had a vendetta with God. It says right here in one of these pages that I marked and forgot, it says God didn't do it. We had these different things that happened to us, God didn't do it. But when I came in, I felt like a victim and a victimizer. I felt like I had been dealt the short stick, and where was my part? And but I was failing to see my part. And so a lot of this stuff over the years has changed. I go to Alan Hancock now, and that was never, I was afraid to do the steps because I had dropped out of school at 17. And so I was like, I can't do school. I don't understand things. I can't learn. And one of my old sponsors, she couldn't read when she did the steps, and she had a AA big book on tape that she listened to. So where there's a will, there's a way. We're very creative. We can find different solutions. That's why I love that word solution, because I felt before like there was only one solution, and it was poison to my body and my mind and my spirit. another thing that, so doing the school, when I went into school, it wasn't like, oh, one day, boom, I'm in school. It was like I had to do therapy for 6 months, going over and over, like, can I do it? Am I strong? And then I signed up and I took one class at night. That's how I grow, really slowly. My seed just germinates. And the flower of who I am comes open organically and naturally. I'm always trying to force things open before they're ready. And so with the school thing, I just took my time. With the steps, I jumped into them because I had been in and out for so long that I was like, oh, I know exactly, like, I'm just going to do this because I have nothing to lose. That's the glorious thing about being so low that you have nothing. You got nothing to lose. Might as well. And that was the attitude that gave me this freedom to just jump all everything in, just jumped. And so I would be picking up a cigarette butt. I would be greeting at the door. I would be doing a lot of things that felt like, you know, I don't want to talk to this person, and I'm talking to this person. And I felt like I was going against who I was, but I was like, do I really want to be someone that I felt like someone that was dangerous to society, that should be kept in the cage because I could not trust myself around other people? I could not trust myself alone with myself. And so doing stuff like greeting people not only helped me get involved because I'm shy, but it also helped me to do that contrary action of talking to different people that I may not necessarily really like that person and want to talk to them, but I'm doing that contrary action and doing that, and it helps out my humility, keeping me right-sized. And so then when I went to school, I took that one class at night, and then the next semester I took, I think it was one or two classes during the day. I've been there for 3 years now, and I'm just going to further my education. I'm not on a fast track. My success doesn't go in a straight line, straight up to the top. It's in a circle, and it kind of goes back a little bit, and it's geared, you know, northwest or northeast. I'm not good with direction, but it's geared up. And progress to me, in the very beginning especially, I had to, one day I'd come home, you know, this happened a lot. I'd be like, man, I messed up over here, and I didn't do that right over there. And then I'd be like, if I didn't pick up today, I'm a winner. I used to say that all the time, and I forgot that I used to say that. I just remembered it the other day. I was like, that's what it comes down to. I have that hope that that things can get better if I'm present, and present for myself, because I abandoned myself over and over and over again and just kept breaking promise after promise to myself. And today my main priority is my program. I know that if I put anything in front of my recovery, I'll lose it, because I've got this disease called alcoholism. It centers in my mind, and if I don't do the maintenance every day, then it's going to build up on itself and snowball, and it starts real small. The meetings are the last to go. It's stuff that's happening with me while I'm still going to meetings, like playing judge, jury, and executioner, and all of a sudden it becomes me and you guys. And that's the way this kind of thing starts with me, is this slow erosion. So I'm really thankful that Stan gave me an opportunity to practice my program by sharing. Even by coming up and reading the How It Works or whatever, you get a chance to practice your program. That's definitely a gift. And let's see, another thing that has happened now in sobriety is that I'm an aunt, and I never held kids before. I was afraid I'd drop them. I have all these fears. That was one of my things. I had all these different phobias, and one of them was I can't hold kids. I don't have kids, and I don't know what they do, and they might break or something in my arms. And so my sister had a baby last year, and I've held him. I've, you know, been there to, going to bring him his Easter basket on Sunday and stuff like that. And this was all the kind of stuff that I felt like, you don't ever want to be around me because my toxicity might rub off on you. That was how my self-esteem was when I came in, and it took me several years. I'm still working on it because I repeat this thing to myself, and it goes like this. I'm complete as I am. Nothing outside of me can complete me. I'm perfect as I am. because I want to be all these other things, and I'm at war with reality. My God lives in reality. Whatever's happening to me in reality is what is. What, that's my job to make peace with it, not my job to get in there, analyze it, switch it around the way I wrote the script. And so I've really been like doing a lot of work with being at one with the moment. And they say die to each moment. I surrender, living in a constant state of surrender. Because my disease, that ism of I, self, me, comes out in the controls, the controllingness, and it gives me all this fear, anxiety, all kinds of stuff. And that was what I was self-medicating with, alcohol and whatever else, really, because it's taken other forms in sobriety that I've noticed. When I do my 10th step and I see, like, where is it coming out? I see it coming out in other ways, and it takes that diligence. I was diligent every day to maintain whatever kind of buzz I could maintain. So that's the hope that I feel like every day if I put in a bit of work, this stuff adds up, and they say that half measures availed us nothing, and I just kept coming back that one more time and that one more time, and it availed me something. I mean, they called me Half Measures. That was my nickname. And I was like, well, I'm here. And so I know that I had to keep falling down over and over to get the willingness. And I quit praying for strength and I started praying for willingness, because I can have all the strength in the world. And if my mind is closed, I'm used to no one, especially myself. So I'm working on keeping an open mind, using different language. The way that I talk to myself is really, really important. The way that I treat others is really, really important. The way that I know how to do boundaries is really, really important. These are all things that I've asked my sponsor and I've asked other old-timers about in here, and I'm really, really glad for the newcomers, because they also remind me of exactly what happens if I decide to play the same old game again. I really, you know, appreciate seeing that nothing's changed. That's a service that newcomers do that they may not even know that they're seeing, that they're doing for other people. And then there's old-timers that go out and relapse and come back, and they may have lost all these, you know, house, car, all these different things before they come back, they lost their soul. And that's exactly the way that I felt that millionth time, was just like dead inside. I was gonna hang myself in that rehab. I was like planning stuff. I did not see a way out, but they say don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle happens. And I just kept, okay, I'm eking by on 5 more minutes, because I used to say before, I'm living on a bowl and a prayer. I used to say that all the time. And now it's like, okay, I'm living on a prayer, and that has sustained me for 5 years. Simple prayers, like, thank you, God, you know, help, stuff like that. It comes through. Another prayer that I really liked was, I'm not sure what your will is for me today, God, so if you could show me a real easy sign that could be easy for me to understand and comprehend and see today, because I need guidance. That was a really helpful one that people shared with me. I've been dealing with some chronic pain in sobriety, and I haven't been in physical pain except for when I was out there, so I don't really know how to deal with that. In sobriety, and luckily there's other people around that have been through that story. I'm so glad that everyone has their piece to my puzzle to offer. And likewise, the longer that, I mean, my dream is to get old in this program. That's my dream. And before, my dream was party like a rock star. That was my dream. And, you know, the rock star gets old. I started looking at, okay, I'm almost 30 years old. Am I, you know, and I was just like, I can't, what I can see happening to me if I decide to let my self-will run riot is me coming in at 60 years old saying, I had 5 years once. And I keep telling myself that story because that's the type of relapser I am. So I do the Back to the 40s every week, which is a 5-week study of the steps, the way they did it back in the 40s. And it's a thing that came from Clarence Snyder. And it's really helped me get a really sturdy foundation because people kept telling me, you have to do step 12, you have to sponsor. And even at 3 years sober, I was like, I don't really know what to tell you. I can't sponsor. I don't remember. It took me a year and a half to do my first set of steps. And I didn't remember what I did in the very beginning. So I was trying to pass stuff on and people were relapsing because I was like so flimsy with my guidance. And somebody told me that if someone's sick enough to ask you to sponsor them, you better sponsor them. They really need you. So I would sponsor people, but it would kind of be, they'd be a little less serious about recovery. And then an old timer told me, you have to pay your dues when you're young because that's what happens in early sobriety. You get a lot of weeble wobblers early in sobriety. And that's exactly the wrench for my nut. That's exactly the way that I was every single excuse, every single last one. And at the end of the day, it was, I'm afraid to be wrong. And I've got fear, heavy fear, and hurt, deeply hurt. Those were like, really, if I could just dumb it down to really small words, because I get so lost in what I've drummed up in my mind, that reality is a... it seems like I'm terminally unique, and those kind of attitudes can kill. So, what else has happened in recovery? Because I spent so much time telling war stories in my last pitch that I was like, I'm going to stay away from all these war stories. We all know what happens. That's why we're spending Sunday night at 7:45 in this room. I mean, being pounding the pavement for my recovery is so important. I know that when at 3 years when I didn't understand how to sponsor others, I had done the steps, but that was the last thing on my list. I'd done service, and those were all the things that I hadn't done before those 8 years. I would do steps 1, 2, and 3 and not really stay in touch with the sponsor. That was as far as I would go with the program. And this time I did the whole thing except for sponsorship. And so I found yet another sponsor to try and get through steps with, and she took me through Back to the 40s in the 5 weeks, and ever since then, I've been sponsoring like crazy, just all the time, and I'll meet with people that don't have cars, homeless people, they'll walk out of the mountains in San Luis and meet with me at the park, and we'll read through Back to the 40s classes, because it takes my opinion out of it. It was just a set of beginner's classes that goes through the steps, and I think they used to have a Back to the 40s meeting here, or somewhere in Santa Maria a couple years ago. But when I started doing that, I started seeing lights turn on, and that was stuff that I never got to experience before. I never got to be the one on the other end. I was always somebody with my hand out. I never got to be the other one saying, here, let me try my best to provide you with these tools. And then I had a sponsee that would never do the reading in between because there's like sections of the book that you have to read in between to get through the first 103 pages. And my sponsor told me, the sponsee isn't ready to hear it. That's why they're not doing the reading. It's not up to you to motivate them or be more this or more that to make sure that they get it. Because my controllingness was coming out in every single which way to try to control the progress of my sponsees even. So like I said about the surrender, those simple concepts were the keystones. And those are the same things that I apply to any last question that I have, is the principles of self-honesty, hope, faith, perseverance, justice, and brotherly love, willingness, humility, courage, and integrity. They're all out of order, but hey, I'm learning, I'm progressing, and honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, those were the three that I was like, these are indispensable. Even if I'm messing up in all these other ways, if I keep centering back on that, and then I went through this phase where I felt like everything was falling away from me and it was freaking me out. And my sponsor said that a tool that she used when there was all this chaos going on in her life in recovery was higher power program sobriety. And these three, you'll be okay. And so I started putting a HP and an F on my fingers every day. I did that for a few months because I kept centering on the gratefulness that I'm tapped in with my higher power. I'm cultivating that conscious contact. My program, I'm going to meetings, I'm working steps with others, doing my commitments, and my sobriety. And you gotta have my sobriety to make this machine go. And she had her thumb like this because she said if your higher power isn't there, it'll collapse in on itself. And so it's really important for me to develop that spiritual solution. Absolutely vital. I don't know what I would do if I still felt like I did, where I felt like this life leads to nothing, it means nothing, I'm spinning on a rock in outer space in blackness. That's the way that I thought when I came in here, and it was very nihilistic. And a friend of mine says, I'm scared of people without a God because they don't have anyone to answer to. They can do anything. And so I was that type. That was my leverage. I don't believe in anything, so I'm just gonna rage on you. But at the same time, with that other coin of me being with my controllingness, I had to suffer the consequences of trying to constantly be in control. And there's always, I wouldn't leave the house because there was a confrontation anywhere that I'd go. And today I walked throughout my day and went different places and it was fine. I tend to take things for granted. I get just a bit of, used to what's going on today, and I forget exactly what it took to get here. And so I stay willing, and I hit different, they call it like a second bottom when you're in sobriety and something happens to you where you feel like, what now? And when that happens, I'm using it to develop the spiritual solution. And I watch the birds at the beach, and those seagulls, some of them try and fly against the wind, and they're fighting it. And I watch them, and they're hovering, and they're trying to go this other way. And this wind is, and then they'll glide, and they'll go along the wind. And I use that. I use these birds as a metaphor. I have these birds right here, and because they're all about surrender, they change their sails, but they ride the wind because they're trying to go against that wind the other way. Reality always wins. Just like on a motorcycle, pavement always wins. And so that's what I remember those two together. Reality always wins. So it's up to me to become at peace with what is. When I was deep in my disease, I changed everything to meet my disease, the requirements of my disease. And now I'm changing my perception in here, in my heart, and going that long distance journey from here to here. Just a few inches, but it's the longest journey. And taking that as my solution instead of, if everybody else would just change. Because if I got what I, like, I love that part, and there's a story in the back, and at the very end, sometimes I read that ending part because it says, if I had got what I wanted, it wouldn't have been what I needed, and what I needed, I got, and I found it was what I wanted all along. And that's exactly the way this thing always happens. I wanted that instant gratification, and I found that I was living this life based on content and form, and now I'm trying to live this life based on presence and awareness, walking hand in hand with my Creator. It's really exciting, and it has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. I live on my own now. I did that last year. That was another thing because I'd always relapse when I live alone. That was one of my things. I get in my head at night and in the morning. And I've lived on my own for over a year now. And they say, nothing changes if nothing changes. If you want to see things differently, do things differently. And so I did all kinds of different things to set up a foundation where I live to make it a really positive environment. And some people call it nesting. I guess that's like the phase that I'm in right now. And it's really neat to be like growing old in the program. And I never thought that that, as hokey as that sounds, that that's would be what I would want. But one of the tools that I used was that St. Francis prayer, because that prayer and meditation is so vital. And I love the end, how it says it's by self-forgetting that one finds, and it's by forgiving that one's forgiven, and it's by dying that one awakens to eternal life. That's my favorite part, because that rock star had to die. And these different attitudes, all this stuff, I could, you know, try and grab all this other stuff to make me feel okay. My best bet is my attitude. That's where I get my power to overcome powerlessness. Walking hand in hand with my higher power, it helps me change my attitude, which is really super important. And luckily, you guys have been loving and tolerant with me thus far. And when I find different spots that I feel aren't loving and tolerant, it's not up to me to sit there and point the finger and change it all around. I just go and find another spot. Or I start a new meeting. Or, you know, I go and get a speaker tape from the central office and listen to that. All kinds of things. And my friend told me, like, I need a meeting at 2 in the morning, and they don't have them at that time up here, and I'm used to the meetings in LA. And I said, guess what? Here's your meeting at 2 in the morning right here. Right in the back, there's all these different chairs, and then you can be connected into a little 10-minute speaker pitch. And so those are the different types of tools that I keep trying to use, and they say if you don't use it, you lose it. So I'm just going to keep coming back, and that's all I have to share tonight.
Okay, the speaker will be available at the meeting to thank for her share. We want to thank her one more time. Charles, will you close up?